Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/truetransparencypricing. Happy you'll be if the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Clay Travis, Outkick the Coverage. He's presented by thehomeloanexpert.com. Clay, did you end up buying the tickets for Vanderbilt, Georgia?
No, I haven't. I couldn't believe how expensive they were. I've got three boys, a wife. I mean, if they're $250 each, I'm not willing to drop $1,200 to go watch Vanderbilt get their brains beat in by Georgia. So I think I'll let Georgia Bulldog fans continue to drive those prices up and just sit back and watch a lot of those games on television, which honestly, I mean, if I have to pay a lot of money to go watch a game in person as opposed to just kick back and watch 10 at home all day Saturday, I'd rather watch 10 at home, honestly.
Clay, you watched Florida-Miami on Saturday night. Did your opinion of what Florida's season is going to look like change with that performance from the Gators?
Well, I thought Felipe Franks was really bad. And I certainly what Dan Mullen is hoping is that he can mold Felipe Franks into a version, and I'm saying a version, of Tim Tebow or Dak Prescott, sort of that big physical pocket presence who may not be a traditional passer in, you know, a lot of ways that you would define it. But you get him down close to the goal line, he scores like a bloodhound there. Third and fourth down, he's always going to get 2 or 3 yards trying to run that quarterback sneak out of the shotgun, which we've seen happen so many times over the years. And I think Felipe Franks is just a poor decision maker who does a poor job of recognizing what the defense is doing. The interception that he threw with 4.5 minutes to go and the reaction from Steve Spurrier, what I saw from Florida made me convinced that they are not a top 10 team and that they are not a legitimate contender with Georgia for the SEC East crown.
Clay, you know, there was a lot of hype around Chip Kelly in UCLA a year ago, and I was almost surprised. I'm looking at the opening weekend and see that the primetime slot on ESPN on Thursday night featured Chip Kelly in UCLA against Cincinnati, and there's just very little talk about Chip Kelly and UCLA in year two. I know you've talked about this a lot. The great coaches out there, you see a pretty sizable jump in year two at a school. Are we going to see that this year with Chip Kelly and UCLA? And if not, what does that say about Chip Kelly? What does that say about the UCLA football program?
Well, we certainly didn't see it last night.
No.
If anything, it looked like UCLA had gotten worse compared to Cincinnati, who they played last year in year one of Chip Kelly. I mean, I thought that UCLA was just absolutely a disaster. They made two plays all night long on offense. And so, in general, I think that, that's ominous for UCLA. Now, maybe Cincinnati's really good. I mean, there's always that that factor, and certainly Cincinnati won 11 games last year, and Luke Fickell seems to have things going well. They had a very good home field advantage. But I didn't think that that Cincinnati played particularly well. They gave the ball away a couple of times in what should have been easy scoring opportunities. They missed a chip shot field goal. They may well have gotten away with a fumble with about, you know, 2 minutes to go in that game or whatever that could have made it interesting down the stretch. But yeah, look, usually in year two is when you become aware if you're going to have a really, really good coach. Maybe UCLA's program was just in such dire straits and that Chip Kelly just hasn't been able to recruit it back up, and maybe it will take year three for him. But by and large, most of the time, year two is where the big jump kind of arises. And so far we haven't seen that.
Clay, I'm getting crushed by Michigan fans once Aubrey Solomon was ruled eligible. Asking me to retract my statements that I think Jim Harbaugh isn't going out of his way to help transfers from his program get eligible. The fact that he's ruled eligible Tennessee doesn't change my mind on that, because I do think that Jim Harbaugh isn't helping anyone who leaves his program, and he's probably saying negative things about them to the NCAA. We had Stephen Godfrey on our show yesterday. He said, you can believe what you want, but college football coaches, to a man, everyone he talks to, believes the power in the transfer process lies with the coach of the player from where they're transferring from and what they say to the NCAA. Do you believe that Jim Harbaugh not only is not going out of his way to help players who transfer from his program, but is probably going out of his way to hurt players who transfer from his program, like Luke Fickell has said and like Jeremy Pruitt alluded to?
Potentially. I mean, that's the kind of information that I think should be out there if it's true, because that's the kind of thing I'd want to know if I were a parent. If you send somebody off to school and it doesn't work out for whatever reason with them, are you going to be draconian in the way that you handle their request to leave, or are you going to try to welcome them and encourage them as best you can, particularly, again, when you're transferring out of conference and you are not going to be playing against anybody in that comp, in that school again. Now, I'm sure there are always extenuating circumstances. If you believe as a head coach that somebody has improperly targeted or recruited your player, you may be less likely to be comfortable signing off on them being able to play elsewhere. But I think this is one of the things that college football should just clean up, right? I mean, my argument has been for years, everybody in college football should get one opportunity to transfer as long as they're in good academic standing and play wherever they want. After one transfer, then you have to sit out for a year. So coaches, the standard is pretty straightforward. A coach, Jim Harbaugh, tomorrow, if he wanted to, could leave and be coaching somewhere else next year. To me, players should have that opportunity too. And some people get upset by that. So how would you manage rosters? To me, the answer is pretty straightforward. It is somebody has to be willing to take you. And if somebody's not willing to take you, then you probably should stay where you are or transfer down to a smaller level if you really need to leave. But I think that would solve a lot of these problems if the default is we're going to accept the waiver request as opposed to trying to look through this list and figure out why one guy becomes eligible and somebody else does not.
Clay, what would it take for you to bet that it would not be Clemson against Alabama for the national championship this year?
Well, I mean, I think it's always hard to project these two teams. I mean, look, you could have Trevor Lawrence get injured. You could have Tua get injured. As big and important as quarterback positions have become in college football, that's really all it would take. And both those teams could still be really good, but they could be 11-1 and 10-2 and lose to somebody in a championship game, something along those lines. So I think that Alabama and Clemson are both going to make the college football playoff. I think Clemson even more so is likely than Alabama because they're likely to be a 17-point or more favorite on everybody on their schedule. And I could make you a decent argument that Clemson now is kind of like what USC was back when the rest of the Pac-12 stunk, but USC was really good. I think that's kind of where Clemson is with the ACC, where there's really, really just Clemson and nobody else that can challenge them for the crown. But we saw what happened with Alabama, even with Jalen Hurts as the backup when Tua Tagovailoa was not 100%. So I would be a little bit nervous now with Jalen Hurts at Oklahoma if I were an Alabama fan, thinking about what would happen if Tua did get hurt again and you had to go into the backup realm.
Who is the second best team in the ACC?
Probably Syracuse would be my guess. I mean,
they're ranked right now.
Yeah, certainly people could argue otherwise. We'll see how they do against Liberty on Saturday. They play against Hugh Freeze and Liberty down in Virginia on Saturday. But I think, I mean, look, Miami would be the other team that some people would point to and say, hey, I think this is the top 25 caliber team, but they certainly didn't look like it.
No.
Against Florida in the opening week of the season. So I think if you were looking at the ACC top to bottom, the second best team in that conference is probably Syracuse.
It's just bizarre that the ACC launches this network and they have Syracuse as the second-best football team of the conference right now, over Florida State, Miami, and others.
Well, I think that's the challenge that they're in, right? There should be. There are basically three what I would call shadow SEC programs in the ACC. Clemson, Florida State, and to a certain extent, Miami. And those are three, and maybe you could argue in some years, Virginia Tech, those are three or four that are SEC-like in their infatuation with football. And Miami's a little bit different because it's a private school. But in terms of the quality of player that they bring in and the history of pedigree of the program, those are sort of shadow SEC programs. The other 10, by and large, are not football schools. And so I think that's the challenge, is driving interest and getting people to kind of demand the ACC network. I don't have it. I didn't watch it last night. And there's not a lot of games that I've seen so far where I've said, hey, I have to have it to watch this game in the ACC, because most of Clemson's big games, which are the ones that matter on a big national stage, will be on ABC, ESPN, or ESPN2.
And the other banner program in the ACC currently is Duke, and they're a 36-point underdog to Alabama on a neutral field on Saturday. When we come back, we're going to get Clay's thoughts on expectations for the Titans now that the preseason is over. But first, Clay, tell us about Ryan Kelly, the home loan expert.
Yeah, the home loan expert. Look, rates are down insanely low, around 3.5% for a 30-year mortgage. That is just off the charts. Wild how low it is. If you haven't been paying attention, you can probably refi and save yourself hundreds, if not thousands of dollars just in time for the football season as we roll into, before long, the holiday season. Make the smart financial decision. Hit thehomeloanexpert.com today. That's thehomeloanexpert.com. Lock in a rate that will make you the envy of everyone and save you hundreds, if not thousands of dollars at thehomeloanexpert.com.
Clay Travis with us, presented by thehomeloanexpert.com, with us for another segment. Clay, as you watch Tennessee and Georgia State tomorrow, what are you looking for with the Vols? What do you need to see in a game like this?
One, you want to stay healthy. I mean, I watched some of that BYU-Utah game last night, and BYU certainly didn't look good. And that's a physically challenging game that they played. But Tennessee's not very deep. So I think certainly at key skill positions, among quarterback, among others, you want people to stay healthy. I also think, how can they block and how can they run? And you know, I'm big now on Tennessee kind of starting to be good on the offensive and defensive line. I think that's important to Jeremy Pruitt. I know that was very important to Phil Fulmer back in the day. Kind of build a team from the lines out, because it's easier to find the skill position players, and they look better if you have a good offensive and defensive line around them. How does Tennessee do running the ball, and how do they do stopping the run against Georgia State? Those are probably the things that I would be most focused on.
Clay, your network last night, FS1, had the game of the night in terms of competition with South Dakota State and Minnesota, probably not one people were expecting. But I was drawn to ESPN's broadcast of Cincinnati and UCLA with Matt Hasselbeck and Pat McAfee on the call. It was a different style of game broadcast, where it was a lot more of jokes and conversation and less hardline play-by-play and analysis at times. Do you feel like that's where game broadcasts are going right now, or is this just simply something that's an outlier that ESPN is trying right now that's not going to be the norm?
I think the way it should be going is there should be multiple different versions of a broadcast that you can choose to listen to in your home. And so I think there should be a gambling-focused broadcast for people out there who want a live wager and want to analyze everything from a gambling perspective. I think there should be kind of a funny, zany version of a broadcast crew that you can listen, call a game. And then I think you could have the traditional voice of God, which is kind of your standard default version of a game. And the reason why I say that is I think entertainment is becoming so competitive, and already is in so many different places, that if you have somebody who can call a game and make me laugh, then maybe I'm more likely to watch a game than I would be otherwise. I know they've done this a lot in, for instance, English Premier League soccer, where they have, and they've done this at the NCAA tournament, I guess, as well, where they have like fans of particular teams call games. I think having a huge Alabama, you know, Crimson Tide fan calling a game alongside of an Auburn Tiger fan could be pretty entertaining to watch, right? For instance, would you like to see, I don't know, Greg McElroy for Alabama call a game alongside of Charles Barkley? I mean, and the Iron Bowl. Like, that seems like it could be pretty entertaining, and I'm just tossing at both those guys out because they happen to be alums. So I think there needs to be more progressive kind of risk-taking in terms of who calls the game. Now, the challenge here is the schools want people who are basically going to fluff them, right? They want announcers who are going to make them look good, who are going to praise the team, who are going to praise the coaches. And that's where you get into, this is not a totally independent entertainment-designed calling a mechanism for games. It's got to make the leagues and the coaches and the players and their parents and everybody else happy too, which is why it's not necessarily easy to do, particularly in college compared to the pros.
We haven't had a chance to talk to you since Andrew Luck announced his retirement on Saturday night. I'm curious your thoughts on this part of it, Clay. Do you think that this is a signifier that we're going to see more of these early retirements from quarterbacks that make a lot of money early in their career? Or is this an outlier simply because Andrew Luck is so different than most professional football players with his background? He's affluent, with his education, with his varied interest in life, that it's a special circumstance because of who Andrew Luck is, and you're not going to see a lot of other quarterbacks attempt this.
Well, I think it's probably an outlier, but I would say that as the money goes up, you know, if you're Andrew Luck and you think to yourself, I've already made $100 million, what do I want to do in my life that I can't do with the $100 million that I've made, which, assuming you invest it in a decent manner, you know, in 25 years is $300 or $400 million, right? So you're talking about a guy who is never going to hurt for money and is not only making a ton of money now, he's making a ton of money for generations of his family to come. So I think that that could factor in. And I just think the question that hasn't been asked enough is, what percentage of the American public loves their jobs enough that if they had $100 million, they would keep doing it? And I think that's probably what doesn't get talked about enough in terms of trying to analyze athletes. Everybody doesn't love being a pro athlete. There are people out there who have skills, no matter what they do, that they don't particularly love applying. You might be a plumber who's listening to us right now, and you might be the best plumber in the city of Nashville, and you've honed your craft and everything else. But if you had $100 million, would very many people show up and continue to be plumbers? Would people show up and continue to be teachers? I mean, doctors, lawyers, whatever you do, I think with financial money like that comes the ability to be independent. And there's a lot of people out there, I think, who would enjoy going to bed in the morning at night and know they can wake up in the morning whenever they want and not have to do necessarily anything. To me, to be honest, that's kind of the American dream. I love Friday and Saturday night, like a lot of people do, because when I put my head down on the pillow, I don't really have to wake up and immediately do anything because I've already done my work all week long. I love my jobs. I don't know that I would continue to do them if I had $100 million in the bank.
Clay, you're a Titans fan. With the news of Andrew Luck and with what you've seen from this team in the preseason, this offseason, and where they are right now in year five under Marcus Mariota, how does the Andrew Luck decision change your outlook for the Titans this year and your expectation for what this team should be and what they should accomplish?
Yeah, you know, I think the Titans should be favored in this division. People might think I'm crazy or being a homer there, but when I break down everything, I think Jacksonville's got major structural issues in their locker room. I don't believe that Nick Foles is going to come in and be a magic elixir for them. I think that that Houston still has issues with protecting Deshaun Watson on their line. They've got issues with Clowney not wanting to play as well. They haven't been able to keep Will Fuller healthy outside of DeAndre Hopkins, who is obviously a game-breaking, incredible wide receiver, one of the two or three best in the league. I'm not sure what they have there. They just lost Lamar Miller to an injury. I really like this Titans team, and I'm trying not to get too excited about it because certainly they haven't really shown it in the preseason. But I think the secondary is outstanding, right? Like, let's start there. For a long time, I feel like the Titans have had really low level, it felt like, safety and corner play. And I think they have as good of a secondary as there is in the NFL right now. That could be crazy. You know, Hudson, you guys, Hudson, you've covered this a lot closer than I have, obviously. But I think this is as good of a secondary as the Titans have had in, you know, 15, 20 years almost, when you look at the overall talent that they've got right now. So I love the secondary. I'm not enamored with their ability to get pressure as a rush defensive front. But I do think that that over time, if they can cover in the secondary man-to-man, which I think they can, that can allow them to get pressure sort of as a secondary rush more so than as a primary rush. And on the offensive side of the ball, I mean, I know Taylor Lewan is out, but they've invested a lot of money on the offensive line. They should be decent. I love the way Derrick Henry came on last year. I think Adam Humphrey is going to be a great security blanket for Marcus Mariota. Combining that with Delanie Walker coming back, and should be pretty solid at the tight end, along with Jonnu Smith and some of the younger guys rising up. I think Corey Davis can be a game-breaking style wide receiver if Mariota has time to throw. And so I feel pretty good about the overall talent on this offense and about particularly the secondary in the defense. So I don't understand why the Titans shouldn't be able to make a run at 10-6, which I think wins this division.
Yep, I agree with you, Clay. And we're going to find out pretty quickly how much stock to put into a preseason with Mike Vrabel, because, you know, the old line you mentioned should be better, and they're highly paid. They didn't look very good in the preseason. That's my one big concern. But again, for the most part, the preseason lies. So we'll see what happens in Cleveland against their pass rush. If they can protect Marcus, I completely agree with what you said. Hey, give me some of your best bets from just some of the top 25 matchups tomorrow.
Bama's now down to around 32.5. I'm literally looking at the board right now as I'm talking to you guys because I'm doing the Lock It In show. And I just sent in my four bets for today. Now, I've got a bunch up at OutKick. So I'm 5-0 to start the season. So I'm pretty happy about that against the number. I won all three last night. I won both my bets on Saturday on week zero. But to me, I really like Bama now. I think in particular now if the line's down beneath 35. I like the over in the Oregon State and Oklahoma State game, as well as I like Oklahoma State to cover in that one. I got 15 different picks that are up there. I like the over. I'm trying to think of local teams. So I like the over in the Memphis and Ole Miss game. I think there'll be a lot of points scored there. I'm a big fan of the over there. I like the over in the Vanderbilt and the Georgia game. That line's kicked up to Georgia around 22. And the tickets are insanely expensive, so I expect that to be basically a home game for Georgia. And I think Vanderbilt's pretty talented on the offensive side of the ball, so I think they'll score some points. And I think the over-under right there is around 58. So for the local teams, there's several kind of off the top right there.
Clay, enjoy it, man. Glad college football's back.
Can't wait, boys. Enjoy talking with you and talk to you next week.